This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the results of Kenya's presidential election are expected Friday. The Electoral Commission says it is still waiting to receive the official signed forms from all the country's polling stations to ensure they match the electronic results previously transmitted.
That's VOA's Jill Craig with the latest from Nairobi. Details next.
Also, the International Organization for Migration is searching for human smugglers responsible for the deaths of 50 migrants off the Yemeni coast. And the new UN envoy to Libya has arrived in Tripoli.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the results of Kenya's presidential election are expected tomorrow. The Electoral Commission says it is still waiting to receive the official signed forms from all the country's polling stations to ensure they match the electronic results. The opposition continues to dispute the results released so far, saying their candidate, Raila Odinga, is the rightful winner. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has the latest.
Kenyans are still waiting to learn the outcome of Tuesday's presidential poll pitting incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta against opposition leader Raila Odinga. As of Thursday afternoon, election officials were waiting to receive about 170 forms from the country's 290 constituencies and about 1,000 forms from the 40,883 polling stations. The chairman of Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, Wafula Chebukati, said Thursday, "We are now in the final stretch.
All the presidential results from returning officers will reach the National Tallying Center by 12 p.m. tomorrow, that is the 11th of August."
The expectation is that the announcement of the winner will be made soon thereafter. Provisional tallies released by the Electoral Commission so far show Kenyatta with a 9-point lead on Odinga. However, the opposition is rejecting those results as fraudulent, saying the Electoral Commission's computer networks were hacked. On Thursday, the Electoral Commission chief confirmed that there was an attempt to hack the system after the vote, but he said that attempt failed. The opposition says its calculations show Odinga beating Kenyatta by a margin of more than 600,000 votes. The leader of the opposition NASA coalition, Musalia Mudavadi, spoke to reporters Thursday.
"We demand that the IBC chairperson announce the presidential election results forthwith and declare the Right Honorable Raila Amolo Odinga as the duly elected president of the Republic of Kenya."
There have been pockets of unrest in the country, like in Kisumu, as well as Mathare and Kibera slums in Nairobi, where burned tires have been smoldering in the road since Wednesday. But Kibera resident George Omondi Otieno says that no matter the outcome, people need to resist violence.
"Even if I'm celebrating, let me celebrate in a way that may not provoke the other person. Because if I celebrate in a way that provokes the other person, that escalates. That feeling, that may end up people fighting, of which we don't want."
And as the Electoral Commission finalizes its work, the country continues to wait. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
International election observer missions have given Kenya's nationwide vote Tuesday passing grades. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
International election observers called for restraint Thursday as Kenyans await the announcement of the official results from the nationwide polls. Tensions have risen as the opposition alleges foul play, saying the voting system was hacked in favor of the incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta. Former U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry led the election observation mission from the U.S.-based Carter Center alongside former Senegalese Prime Minister Aminata Touré. Kerry urged Kenyans to follow due process in challenging any results, including the allegations of hacking.
"Nobody should dismiss anything out of hand. It needs to be examined. It needs to be judged whether or not, if it did happen, there was any material impact on the election itself. And we have to get to the bottom of that. But there's a way to do that. And what we're arguing is that people need to adhere to the legitimate process for following up on this."
the Carter Center, along with observation missions from the U.S.-based National Democratic Institute, the African Union, the Commonwealth, and the European Union, said the voting on Tuesday appears to have been open and credible. Former South African President Thabo Mbeki led the AU mission, which sent 43 teams of observers to 400 polling stations around the country.
The people were permitted to vote in a manner which met the standards set in Kenya law, which was also consistent with the policies of the African Union. And similarly, the process of counting the votes at the polling stations was done in a transparent manner, with the participation of the agents of the political parties. Accordingly, we can say that the processes, as we were able to observe, up to and including the counting of the votes at the polling stations and their transmission to the IEBC and so on, met the standards set by Kenya and the AU for the conduct of democratic elections.
The European Union Observation Mission said it has seen no signs of manipulation of the process. However, Chief EU Observer Marietje Schaake told VOA their analysis is ongoing.
Results are still coming in. And of course, the key question is always, were elections free or fair? But we look much more comprehensively at the entire election process, the campaign, election day, what happens afterwards. And we're going to reflect in more detail on what we see. So these are not the kinds of terms that we use, and we're still in the middle of assessing how things went. On election day itself, people were waiting patiently, casting their votes, and generally the procedures were followed according to Kenyan law on election day. But election day is one chapter in a longer electoral process.
Kenyans cast their ballots in presidential, parliamentary, and local elections. The constitution gives the IEBC a period of 7 days to officially declare winners of all contested electoral seats. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
The International Organization for Migration says it is searching for human smugglers who, it says, forced 120 Somalis and Ethiopians into the sea as their vessel approached the Yemeni coast. More than 50 teenage migrants drowned. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
Survivors tell migration officials the smugglers panicked and forced the migrants into the choppy sea when they saw Yemeni authorities as they approached land. International Organization for Migration spokeswoman Olivia Hayden tells VOA the migrants knew they could die but were helpless to resist.
There was one lead smuggler who was directly instructing the migrants, but he did have other smugglers working on the boat with him who were armed with guns and other weapons. So the migrants had a choice. They would either be harmed more than they'd probably been already on the journey, shot, or jump into the sea. Some were actually physically pushed as well.
The IOM says 29 people died, 22 are still missing and presumed drowned. Hayden says 42 people left the beach before IOM staff could reach them. She says 27 surviving migrants, both females and males around 16 years old, are receiving urgent medical and psychological care. After the smugglers dumped their human cargo, she says they turned back to Somalia to pick up more people and bring them back on the extremely dangerous, deadly voyage.
Boats are making this journey all the time, where people are being abused and raped en route so that their families will pay more. Some people are paying as little as 100 US dollars, but then en route they're tortured, they're abused, their families are made aware of this and are forced to pay up to $1,000 or $2,000 more.
Hayden says it is unlikely the smugglers will be caught. Nevertheless, the IOM is trying to gather more information on the smugglers to pass on to the authorities. She says greater international cooperation is needed to halt or reduce the trade in human beings. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A comprehensive new study finds RDT's rapid diagnostic tests for malaria are reducing the overuse of malaria medications. However, the study also found some surprising unintended results. researchers at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine analyzed 500,000 patient visits across malaria endemic regions of Africa and Afghanistan. One unexpected result found many of these patients were being given antibiotics or malaria drugs despite testing negative for malaria. Dr. Heidi Hopkins was one of the researchers conducting the study. She spoke with me about the study's findings.
This was an analysis of data from 10 different studies that were designed in a harmonized way, and those studies were conducted by an international team of collaborators across several African countries and also one Asian country, Afghanistan. In all of these studies, rapid diagnostic tests for malaria were implemented in different settings, in public health facilities, in community health worker environments, in private clinics. The overall finding was that RDTs do help us appropriately and safely reduce the use of antimalarial medicines, in particular artemisinin combination therapies.
At the same time, you all did make some other findings, some that were maybe surprises or concerns that you found in your study.
That's right. So in addition to the positive impact in terms of appropriately reducing the overuse of antimalarials, we also found two things in particular that surprised us and that were less desirable. Number one, we found that when patients didn't get an antimalarial because their test was negative, instead the clinicians or the providers often gave an antibiotic. Sometimes that may be appropriate, but not always, and it's a challenge because that now is going to contribute to antibiotic resistance, bacterial resistance, if we begin to overuse antibiotics instead of overusing antimalarials. The second thing we found that was surprising was that a large proportion, even up to 20% in some cases, of patients who tested positive for malaria were not given an ACT or were not given an antimalaria at all.
So then where do you all go from here? What is your next step?
We'd like to understand more about why providers are making these decisions. Of course, it's not just the technology. If you just put in a rapid diagnostic test in place, that doesn't solve all the problems. The healthcare providers need to understand how the tests work. And more importantly, they need to know what to do when the malaria test is negative. In many parts of the world, no matter how much training you have, no matter how much capacity you have, it's very challenging to determine what's causing a case of fever if it's not malaria. And we need to do better at getting the evidence and teaching the providers and ourselves what to do when a malaria test is negative.
Why is it such a challenge to treat malaria?
Malaria is not that hard to treat. If you've got a blood test that's showing that a patient has malaria and you have the appropriate medicine, which in most parts of the world now is an artemisinin combination therapy or ACT, if you can get the good quality drug to the patient and the patient can take it appropriately, that malaria will be gone. It's not that hard to treat malaria.
Why is it that some people who were diagnosed with malaria, they did not receive the treatment?
We have the same question. We don't have evidence to explain that clearly because we didn't expect that result and therefore we didn't go looking for the reason. I can maybe speculate, having spent a lot of years in different African settings myself and watched how health workers work, I could suppose that even if there was not a shortage of drugs in these study sites, people who are used to working in settings where there are drug shortages, where there are stockouts, people run out of medicine, maybe they have a way of thinking that they want to conserve the medicines they do have, maybe for sicker patients, maybe for somebody who's less able to go and buy separately. So I'm just speculating. We don't have any evidence to support that, but that's one reason that comes to mind when we think about why this might have happened.
And also in looking at those people who tested negative and still were receiving some type of medicine, even antibiotics, what would you think the mindset be for that?
I think when you're working in a low resource setting and you know that some of your patients are coming from quite a distance away, people come from several kilometers away walking or on a motorcycle, you're reluctant to send them home without something powerful. And people think of antimalarials or antibiotics or certain types of medicines as powerful. And if you don't have a clear diagnosis, still want to do something, the patient wants something, even if the health worker feels like he or she could send the patient home just with some Panadol or paracetamol and fluids, the patient may insist or the parent may insist. And so there's a number of different things that work together to give the outcome.
That was Dr. Heidi Hopkins of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. She spoke with me from Uganda.
Nineteen past the hour, you were listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The new UN envoy to Libya arrived in Tripoli this week. Ghassan Salama has a difficult job because Libya has three different governments, none of which is able to govern. They include the UN-backed Government of National Accord in Tripoli, the Libyan National Army, led by General Khalifa Haftar, and the National Salvation Government. Alaa Abu Zakouk is the former foreign minister of the National Salvation Government. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shanawi about how the new UN envoy is perceived by the major players in Libya.
The feedback from the Tobruk Parliament and the government of Abdullah Tini in Baida. If you add to that the warlord Khalifa Haftar, who is controlling Benghazi, those guys are considered to be, for the Libyan national patriots, are pariahs now. And they have been the cause of most of the difficulties that the people of the eastern Libya have faced, including the besieging the city of Derna as they were besieging the city of Benghazi before. So they didn't like the new UN envoy to start with Tripoli, the capital of Libya. They consider themselves to be the government of Libya, the authority of Libya. Because of that, I think they don't like anything that happens west of Benghazi.
At the same time, the commander of the so-called Libyan National Army discussed the situation in Libya and the different scenarios with the Egyptian Chief of Staff, General Mahmoud Hijazi. What do you make of that?
It shows clearly that the warlord Haftar, from the very beginning, has the backing of the military government of President Sisi of Egypt, which supports him militarily, politically, on all sides. So he might be going there to ask for their advice on what to do about the new development and the new envoy in Libya.
A third party, the Salvation Government, was cautiously optimistic but would gauge the new envoy's success through his ability to lift the siege on the city of Derna. Is that a practical measure for his success and why?
I think it's the least that the United Nations envoy could do is really to lift the siege on the city of Derna, which has been besieged for the last 4 or 5 years. It shows if the United Nations is willing to bring some reality, some real steps of its policy, because Libya is under the control of the Security Council, which means they are responsible for the security and safety of all Libyans. And the request of the Government of National Salvation seems to be the least they could do, the least Mr. Ghassan Salama could do, is really to force Haftar and his allies to break the siege on Derna.
Some analysts argue that while the new UN envoy starts his mission following the Paris meeting between Sarraj and General Haftar, in which they agreed to hold elections and stop fighting, his ultimate success would rely on the amount of support he gets from the international community and a united European strategy. What's your take on that?
France has never been a neutral state in the issue of Libya, has always been backing the warlord Haftar most of the time. And it seems to be playing the cards against the Italians, against also the European Union policy in Libya. But nevertheless, I hope that the Europeans will take a stand to bring stability, security, safety, and maybe a civil government to Libya as soon as possible. As for the bringing of the elections, I don't know how can they make an elections in Libya while the second largest city in the country, Benghazi, about 250,000 of its inhabitants have been forced out. There is at least 500,000 Libyans who are being forced out in internal diaspora inside Libya. Running an elections would never be an easy matter. That is, if it is a feasible matter.
That was Ali Abu Zakouk, the former foreign minister of the National Salvation Government. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shanawi.
The West Africa Ebola epidemic that killed about 11,000 people ended in mid-2016. But that doesn't mean the virus is gone. A new Liberia-based study finds that genetic elements of the Ebola virus still persist in the semen of men who survived over 2 years after the onset of infection. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with study co-author Dr. William Fisher of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Our very first study was to look at what's called convalescent plasma. This is taking blood from an Ebola survivor and taking out the plasma from it, the part of the blood that has a lot of the immune responses, and then giving that to somebody with acute Ebola virus disease with the thought that the person who survived must have generated an effective strategy to overcome that viral infection, and that if we give part of that to somebody else, maybe they would survive. And so in doing this, we came into contact with a lot of survivors who we had to recruit in order to provide this plasma. And over again, we were hearing that the disease did not end with clearance of the virus from the blood. They were telling us that they were having a lot of complications, joint pain, muscle aches, headache, fatigue, things that were impairing their ability to lead a normal life.
The survivors, the people who had these plasma treatments, were still reporting symptoms even after they'd been quote-unquote cured?
That's exactly right. And so we pivoted our research infrastructure to start addressing the needs of the survivors.
What did you want to discover at that point?
Two of the biggest concerns among survivors of Ebola virus disease that I was seeing in the survivor clinic was that they were having joint pains and muscle aches, and they didn't know why they were still having it, even though they had survived Ebola. And number two is that they were concerned about the possibility that they could transmit this virus sexually to their partners. So we set up the study really to address these two concerns of the survivor community. We enrolled participants who had survived Ebola virus disease, and we did a full clinical assessment on them every 3 months. A clinical assessment is really asking questions about any symptoms that were persisting beyond being discharged from an Ebola treatment unit. We also collected blood to look at the immune response in survivors. And we also collected genital fluids, including semen, to look at the persistence of Ebola virus genetic material in these genital fluids. So we had about 158 men who were enrolled in this study, 149 donated semen, and what we found was that 13 were positive, including 11 who donated 2 years after their acute illness, had traces of the virus. We were able to detect genetic material in their semen. This was a very surprising finding.
I'm a little surprised that it's surprising because these people were not asymptomatic. So in a way, maybe they just had a low-grade infection that persisted rather than the apparent eradication of the disease and then boom, there it is, in spite of itself.
So it's interesting. The typical way to be discharged from an Ebola treatment unit is to test your blood and to show that the virus is no longer present in the blood. But what we're learning through the course of this epidemic is that Ebola virus can penetrate different parts of the body, the eye, the testes, and even the fluid that bathes the brain. They don't permit the full immune response in them. And what we've learned over this epidemic is that the virus can actually penetrate these sites and in some cases cause recurrence of disease or cause transmission. There's a number of different groups that are working really hard at trying to determine what is the presence of Ebola virus genetic material in semen represent. Does it represent infectious virus or not? Because that will allow us to make the most informed recommendations, as well as giving personal recommendations about how to practice safe sex. The goal is, on one hand, to make sure that we can prevent transmission, but we have to do it in a way that strategically supports the survivor community and doesn't further stigmatize. I care a lot about this work. I think we owe it to people in West Africa to provide better care. The epidemic didn't end when the last person got discharged from the Ebola treatment unit. In fact, that this disease is continuing to really affect people's lives. And so this keeps me up at night.
That was Dr. William Fisher of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell.
Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.